In what ways does increased concentration of ownership of major news outlets pose a threat to democracy? How has coverage of major stories in Canada changed as a result of mergers and acquisitions, such as the recent takeover of the Sun Media chain by Post Media? Does the arrival of the internet, blogs, and social media compensate for the shrinking diversity within the mainstream media? What are the perils associated with the vertical integration of internet providers with corporate-owned content providers? How can citizens get their media back? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we explore how private control of broadcast, print, and internet media is affecting journalism and democracy. We'll hear from Canadian nationalist, publisher, and author Mel Hertig on the Canadian situation. And we'll hear San Francisco Bay Area independent journalist Kelia Ramirez-Watson interview Tracy Rosenberg, executive director of Media Alliance, on the broader impacts of media consolidation on democracy and freedom of expression. On today's program, Media Consolidation and the Distortion of Democracy, conversations with Mel Hertig and Tracy Rosenberg. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 22, 2015. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. An Australian television show claims to have solved the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 shootdown mystery. The Russians did it. But the program appears to have faked a key piece of evidence, and there remain many of the same doubts as before, along with the dog-not-barking question of why the US government has withheld its intelligence data. The basic point of the Australian 60 Minutes program was that photographs on social media show what some believe to be a Buk anti-aircraft launcher aboard a truck traveling eastward on July 17, 2014. The day of the shootdown, into what was generally considered rebel-controlled territory of eastern Ukraine, south and east of Donetsk, the capital of one of the ethnic Russian rebellious provinces. However, in mid-July, the ethnic Russian rebels were reeling under a Ukrainian military offensive to the north of Donetsk. Despite shifting their forces into the battle zone, they had lost Slovyansk, Druzhkivka, Kostiantynivka, and Kramatorsk. In other words, the lines of control were fluid and chaotic in mid-July 2014, with the possibility that an unmarked Ukrainian government truck, maybe carrying a concealed anti-aircraft battery, could have moved into the titular rebel zone, especially in the lightly defended south. That comes from the article, Fake Evidence Blaming Russia for the Malaysian Airlines MH17 Shootdown, by Robert Perry, posted May 20th, originally appearing at Consortium News. All of these proto-war measures, military, economic, and informational measures aimed at China, correspond to two doctrines which are highly influential in U.S. foreign policy circles, the Brzezinski Doctrine and the Wolfowitz Doctrine. These doctrines essentially call for the U.S. government to exert every effort to attain complete dominance over the Eurasian continent, a continent on which the currently independent countries of Russia and China occupy central positions. Adhering to these doctrines and striving to dominate China and Eurasia through warfare and other means is playing with fire. The U.S. government should take warning that tampering with China's sovereignty is not like invading Iraq or using proxies to destabilize and destroy the previous social order in Libya. China is a powerful nuclear and armed state supported by the majority of its 1.3 billion people and has a long history of struggle against imperialist encroachments on its territory and rights. That comes from the article U.S. Threats Against China, Play with Fire by Eric Summer, posted May 20th, originally appearing at Global Times. We are told that the war dead died for us and our freedom. U.S. Marine General Smedley Butler challenged this view. He said that our soldiers died for the profits of the bankers, Wall Street, Standard Oil, and the United Fruit Company. Neoliberal globalization is now looting its own constituent parts and the planet itself. Americans, Greeks, Irish, British, Italians, Ukrainians, Iraqis, Libyans, Argentinians, the Spanish, and Portuguese are being looted of their savings, pensions, social services, and job opportunities, and the planet is being turned into a wasteland by capitalists sucking the last penny out of the environment. That comes from the article, War is Just a Racket. Memorial Day is a hoax. Our soldiers died for the profits of the bankers, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 21st. On Monday, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev signed a document which revoked a previous decree on NATO cargo transit to Afghanistan, including the delivery of military hardware and equipment via rail, motor vehicles, or by air through Russia. The announcement comes after the expiry of a 2008 decree signed by Moscow to permit the transit of military cargo to the Asian state through its soil and airspace. Russia had signed the decree after the UN Security Council adopted a resolution in 2001 on the establishment of the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, in Afghanistan, calling on all countries to cooperate with ISAF in its mission. NATO, the US-led combat mission in Afghanistan, ended its operation on December 31, 2014. However, thousands of foreign forces have remained in the country in what Washington calls a support mission. That comes from the article, Moscow closes NATO's transport corridor route to Afghanistan via Russia, by Press TV, posted May 19th. 2 weeks ago, Electronic Intifada reported public comments by Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, in which he cited Hiroshima and Nagasaki as role models in responding to Iran. Yaalon suggested that Israel might have to nuke Iran in order to prevent a long war. Quote, at the end, we might take certain steps, unquote. So not only is he implicitly threatening nuclear war, he's admitting that Israel has nukes. But there has been no coverage of this story in the mainstream media. It's a blackout, conscious or not. That comes from the article, Nuke Iran to Prevent War, U.S. media blackout of Israel's defense minister's citation of Nagasaki and Hiroshima as role models for dealing with Iran, by Philip Weiss, posted May 21st, originally appearing at Mondo Weiss. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Last month, Post Media Network Canada Corporation officially closed its $360 million purchase of Sun Media's English language news properties, including 175 newspapers and digital publications from the giant Quebecor. Post Media CEO and President Paul Godfrey said the transaction would make his company one of Canada's largest news media companies with more made-in-Canada offerings for marketers, and Post Media and Sun readers and audiences would be able to enjoy the content that they'd come to expect. With this acquisition, Post Media now controls both major dailies in three Canadian cities, namely Calgary, Edmonton, and Ottawa. There have been prominent critics of this increasing trend of media concentration in Canada. To comment on the takeover and the larger trend, we are joined right now by phone with Mel Hertig. Mel Hertig has been a bookseller, publisher, creator of the Canadian Encyclopedia. He is a political activist and outspoken and unabashed Canadian nationalist. An officer of the Order of Canada, he has authored numerous books, including The Betrayal of Canada, as well as Pay the Rent or Feed the Kids, The Vanishing Country, and Rushing to Armageddon, as well as his most recent, The Arrogant Autocrat, Stephen Harper's Takeover of Canada. So, Mel Hertig, thank you so much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you mentioned in your 2008 book, The Truth About Canada, that you devote an entire chapter to the concept of media concentration. And you mentioned that Canada is, believed second only to Italy among the advanced Western countries as being the most, having the most concentrated media. Well, what is your understanding of what makes Canada so ripe for that kind of media congestion?
Well, I knew you'd start with a tough question. I can't answer why it is, but I can say for sure what it is. We have a situation where in much of the country, we've got the same people owning the television, and the same people owning the newspapers, and the same people owning the magazines, etc. And that's a very unhealthy thing in any democracy. You should always have a good mix of opinion available to your citizens. And in, like, take the market in Vancouver, for instance. You get the same people owning a great deal of the media out here. Take Saskatchewan, for instance. Same thing. The media in Saskatchewan is largely owned by the same people. And we could go right across the country, like New Brunswick, for example, is terrible in that respect. It doesn't make any sense for a good democracy where people have the opinion to get different opinions, have the option, I should say, to get different opinions for the same people to be in charge of what they read and what they see on television.
Now, do you have any kind of a sense of just when, or maybe some key, a key decade or a key event that may have sparked this increasing media concentration? I mean, is there a specific date
that
you have in mind?
No, no. But I can tell you that when Southam controlled all those newspapers, like the Calgary Herald and the Edmonton Journal and some of the papers down east as well, they at least had pretty good degree of editorial independence. But that is obviously not the case right now. You get the case where the a lot of the feed into these newspapers, for instance, it comes from the same source. And again, that's not healthy at all. We want to have really good writers writing for the different newspapers, and we want to have different opinions on television as well, and we're not getting that at all. We're getting an appearance of the country different from what it really is.
Do you, I mean, looking back, say, over the last 30 years, I mean, what are there particular stories or newsmakers that you can identify as a, wait a second, the way we've covered our stories has changed significantly in the time that this major concentration is taking place? I mean, can you give an example, a specific example? You mentioned that the Southam, some of the changes with the Southam newspapers. How is that being expressed in terms of what we as consumers see? What's changed?
Well, the biggest change is that at one time you had a diverse opinion in the media. You had very good journalists, and you would get a variety of opinions. But today, much of the opinion in these big chains is so far right of center that you're not even sure what country you're in.
Speaking of right of center, looking back, say, well, what do you recall from the 1970s and 1980s, the way a group like the Fraser Institute or the National Citizens Coalition would have been covered or, you know, the way that the press would interact with them then as opposed to now?
Well, your question is a very good question. When you see a reference to the Fraser Institute, they're usually on the front page of the newspaper, and it usually discusses a new report that the Fraser Institute has just published. And they never refer to the right-wing Fraser Institute. Or, on the other hand, when the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternative produces a new report, It's usually on page 46, and they're always referred to as the left-wing Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. How fair is that? I don't think it's very fair at all. And it's symptomatic of what has happened in the media. Some of the main columnists today writing for the Post, for instance, they really are so far to the right, it's a wonder they can walk down the street without colliding with somebody.
So, as you expressed in the Truth About Canada, we're seeing, with this concentration, we're seeing a shift from the public interest to market interests. What does that mean for specific stories?
Well, the market interest is one where what happens in financial matters dominates the perspective that people are supposed to pay attention to when there's a new takeover or a new development in mining or in the petroleum industry or whatever. Quite often, these developments are not in the public interest, but quite often, the media ignores the fact that the public interest is not being served.
Now, there's our big state broadcaster, the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Do you see the way the news has been portrayed on the CBC at changing? And do you connect that at all with, because they are public, so they shouldn't, in theory, they shouldn't be affected by media concentration. But are we seeing changes in the way CBC covers the news, and why?
Well, you're very perceptive, but you remember the fact that the CBC operates on a restricted budget, and over a course of several governments, the budget of the CBC has been cut by hundreds of millions of dollars, and that means that all kinds of layoffs of personnel, and consequently, obviously, this has to affect the quality of the news that the CBC generates.
I seem to recall... Well, I'll just give you like a specific example, like the whole free trade debate. I've noticed like back in the 1980s, I mean, you were very much at the forefront of the battle against the free trade agreement, as were people like Maude Barlow and Linda McQuaig and others. I don't see those figures getting much airplay even on the CBC. On the other hand, we do see figures like Kevin O'Leary as being presented in a sense as the voice of reason. So do you see that as a kind of consistent with the shift towards...
Well, again, you're very perceptive. The quality of the commentators has really deteriorated a lot. There's a lot of good commentators still out there, but really the right wing has dominated the whole discussion of so many different developments that occur almost on a weekly basis in the country. And again, what has that got to do with democracy? That's not democracy. That really is, especially when you curtail the CBC's budget so badly, that really, really hurts the dissemination of fair and balanced news coverage.
And the spectrum of debate is extremely limited. I think that, for example, in the CBC, and again, like it is a state broadcaster, but I think this is reflected elsewhere. They, you know, it's taken as a given that the free trade agreements have been good for Canada and for
exactly. And there's very little investigative reporting going on, especially in terms of economics. To determine how are certain matters happening in the country determining the standard of living of Canadians. I would suggest to you that so many things that happen on a weekly basis need further investigation and further discussion, and instead we get the Kevin O'Leary's of the world who will come up at you with a very limited perspective.
You've made an interesting point about stories on climate change and that news item, which is very much a clear and present danger. And the it's interesting that you cite the fact that there are these companies, oil companies, that have been putting a lot of resources into, you know, into how the that dynamic of climate change is portrayed in the media, and the media seem to be playing ball. How is that? I mean, does it come down to just incompetence, or is there some sort of a fiduciary connection there? How do you understand that deterioration of a proper coverage of a subject like climate change?
Well, what's happening with climate change in Canada is a tragedy. It's unlike anything that I know of is happening anywhere else in the world. We are operating in this country as if climate change was not a fact, was not a factor in so many different developments in terms of our weather, in terms of our ability to do certain things. Even President Obama is warning the world about climate change, whereas Stephen Harper, he doesn't even mention. You won't find any mention of climate change in the last budget. The same thing is true with Stephen Harper. Incredibly, where Canada has one of the highest rates of child poverty anywhere in the world, you won't ever see Stephen Harper mention the word poverty in his talks. I don't think he's ever mentioned poverty once in any of the speeches he's given across this country over the last decade. And that's indicative of what the man is really like. He does not care about poor people.
But there's also the issue of what the newspaper editors and the newspaper publishers, I mean, why is it not in their interests to... Is there some sort of a conflict between the ability to, you know, properly report on something like climate change? Does that interfere with the bottom line in some capacity?
Well, look, what happens is this. The wealthy people get control of the media, and those wealthy people are going to appoint people on the far right of the political spectrum as the publishers of their newspapers. And those people who are just appointed, they're going to have hire right-wing columnists and journalists. And they will tend to dominate the dissemination of news. Of course, the same thing is true about the television and about the radio as well, to a certain extent. The as long as you have a limited spectrum of the economy controlling the ownership of the media, you're going to have that kind of result.
So it's like with media concentration, you've set up a system that essentially selects for those, you know, people in high places, in, you know, the media conduits, gatekeepers, that will, their attitudes are basically putting profits ahead of the public interest.
well, that has it ever been different than
okay.
that?
Okay. You know, but it's, I guess, the concentration, it just sort of amplifies that effect. Let me just maybe try to relate to you some of the alternative or the opposite viewpoint that's been expressed, that this idea that, well, we have the internet now and we have so many other conduits of information. I think I got an article here that says this Chris Dornan from the Associate Dean of the Faculty of Public Affairs at Ottawa's Carleton University, arguing that this concentration of newspaper ownership is not a concern in a digital age, because the sources of information and the types of content and the ways in which we communicate with each other, you know, with social media and all the rest, that kind of gets around all of these details. Isn't the internet and social media and all these other things, is that not going to make up for the that control of information from the...
Well, you and I and all your listeners know that the internet and social media have been very, very important. But ask me this, how many people at 10 o'clock at night are listening to a news broadcast on one of our networks? How many are glued to some social media stuff on their computer in their bedrooms? It's apples and oranges. These are different things entirely. And the question also is credibility. With the public, who has credibility? Well, the answer is there's more and more skepticism all the time about social media, about the stuff you get on the internet, and people rely on the well-known pundits for most of their information on television news broadcasts.
Mm-hmm. So, how is it possible for things to turn around? Can we stand? Is it possible to block future mergers? It doesn't seem as if the competition bureau is interested, or the CRTC. So, what could be done?
What does that say about the competition bureau and about the CRTC? It shows that they're not doing their job, that they're not interested in their job, that they're not interested in presenting the population of our country with a fair and balanced outlook as to what's going on in the country.
So, I mean, is there something that could be done legally or politically that could reverse the tide?
Yeah, there's something that could be done easily. And I'll be very blunt about it. Dump the Harper government and return Canada to a state of democracy where more people are more interested in fairness and correct analysis than in what the bottom line and the country corporate profit is.
Well, I know that you have very significant concerns about the Harper government, and maybe if we had more time, we could talk about your more recent book. But in fairness, this pattern of concentration in the country began before Harper came to power, no?
Yes, absolutely. But in almost every area that you can think of, whether it's poverty or whether it's distribution of income or whether it's distribution of wealth, or concentration of ownership, it's exacerbated under the Harper government.
Mm-hmm. And the impacts on our democracy, generally.
Well, there's something interesting in my latest book. I don't know of anybody else who's written about the impact of democracy in Canada the way I have in my book. It's to me, what's a country without democracy? And when you tell all your cabinet ministers, no, you can't go to a backyard barbecue without permission from the Prime Minister's office, and you can't accept a speech without permission from the Prime Minister's office, or you can't get up in the House of Commons and say this and this and that without permission from the Prime Minister's office. What kind of democracy is that? That's not democracy. That's where this one man is wanting to be an autocrat and run the country according to his own values and according to his own objectives.
Okay. Well, Malturtig, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think that's raised a lot of very important red flags. I think we've got to, we'll probably have to have another discussion before the next election. And
let's do it.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
We've been joined by Mel Hertig, the legendary bookseller, publisher, and creator of the Canadian Encyclopedia, and the author of the recently released book, The Arrogant Autocrat, Stephen Harper's Takeover of Canada. Next up, we'll hear from San Francisco Bay Area independent journalist and podcast producer Kelia Ramirez-Watson on her recent interview with Tracy Rosenberg of Media Alliance on media consolidation and its impact on democracy and the Fourth Estate. Please stay tuned. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Tracy Rosenberg has worked in the San Francisco Bay Area as Media Alliance's executive director since 2007. According to its website, Media Alliance, quote, was founded with the belief that in order to ensure the free and unfettered flow of information and ideas necessary to maintain a truly democratic society, media must be accessible, accountable, decentralized, representative of society's diversity, and free from covert or overt government control and corporate dominance. Media Alliance is a media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Unquote. Rosenberg has organized and advocated for the protection and sustainability of alternative media outlets and for fair representation of women and minorities in the mainstream media. Rosenberg has been very active in the battles for net neutrality and against the merger of media giants Comcast and Time Warner. In an afternoon crammed with conference calls about the merger, she graciously fit me in for a conversation about media monopoly.
They're all getting bigger.
Ben Bagdikian, who wrote The New Media Monopoly, now in its 20th edition, says in that book that five conglomerates control 90% of what Americans see, read, and hear.
Yes.
What do Americans have to fear about these conglomerates, especially politically?
I think what's most scary about huge media companies, just as with large corporations in other sectors of the economy, is that they essentially become larger than the public. They become global entities in terms of the resources that they have, the funds that they bring, the political alliances that they make. So essentially, they're functioning outside of the sort of national and governmental borders that have been set up. And these borders, as much as government can be a problem, are really the only way that the public can express their limitations on these companies. So you essentially end up with sort of a global corporate super order. And I think that we're seeing that not just with the natural resources of the world, but we're also seeing it with our information economy and our information resources.
Is this sort of media consolidation happening internationally?
The internet has essentially collapsed those borders. In other words, we're all getting and providing information across national borders. English is becoming the language of the universe. It always has been for a long time now. And we're not really seeing discrete boundaries between these kinds of communications. One of the most read news outlets in the United States is The Guardian UK. So we're not really recognizably talking about national media anymore. We're talking about global information, which is flying all across the universe. So the rules and the regulations and the breaks on this process really don't compute with our national governments and the institutions that have been set up to regulate. They're not working in the right spheres.
Plus, now we have the specter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, alias NAFTA on steroids.
And the point of the TPP is to essentially collapse government in favor of global corporate hegemony. And the question here is, for natural resources, for the environment, this is a catastrophe. What's the impact for our information resources and for the tools and the methods and the platforms that we use to talk to each other if they too are essentially owned by a global corporate hegemony that answers to no one?
Does the fact that two out of the five major media conglomerates in the U.S. are based beyond our borders mean anything per se?
I don't think that because a media outlet per se is foreign that it's better or worse than a domestic media outlet. What the threat is, essentially, is the size and the comparative power of these entities and the fact that their interests really span nations in terms of the resources that they can marshal and the way that they politically interact when their interests are at stake, which is almost beyond national governments. And it's certainly beyond the somewhat pathetic regulatory entities that are set up.
And how has this been made worse by Citizens United?
Good question. What Citizens United has done is it basically unlocked almost unlimited lobbying and political manipulation resources. In other words, the amount of money that corporations can put forward towards trying to impact government policies entirely in their own short-term, financial, often speculative interests, as opposed to the amount that the public interest can marshal, is now so wildly out of proportion that it's really not even David versus Goliath, which is the normal way of describing these things. We're sort of in another level. We need another biblical story to kind of explain the difference in height between these two entities.
Noah versus the flood.
Exactly. I mean, something really small and something really big.
How much of the search problem is political? And how much is technical?
Well, I mean, you know, the search problem can be said in one word, which is Google, because Google has basically turned search into a monopoly. I know that there are other search engines, and I use them sometimes, but the reality is that Google has set the terms for what search is. And when you have a company that is that large and that influential in what gets clicked on and what doesn't get clicked on, the route to any sort of change goes through that company in a way that's a little freaky when you're talking about something that's that huge. I don't think you're ever going to have a scenario where you can convince people to go back 20 pages of search results to look at things. There's not that much time in the day and there's too much information out there. So the fight is about what are the criteria for what appears on the front page and what input or control or regulation can exist regarding that. And it's very difficult because we've essentially privatized search. It's a service offered by company. They can offer it on whatever terms they want. And within sort of a free market argument, we can't tell them what to do. And if we don't like it, we can use some other search engine. Except, as we all know, you really can't. I mean, Google it is a verb because it means something, you know? DuckDuckGo, it is not quite the same thing, and I like DuckDuckGo, but it's not the same thing. And, you know, personally, I use Firefox, but, you know, still.
Firefox claims they prefer Yahoo, but I always switch the box.
I have Google set as my search engine because, frankly, I don't find what I'm looking for in other search engines.
The European Commission is charging Google with violation of the European Union's antitrust laws.
And, you know, they're causing them some aggravation and frustration, no doubt about it. But we don't even know about it in the U.S. It's like it's not even happening. And it doesn't affect our Google relationship. So the ability of the particular entities trying to act on behalf of the public are smaller than the company that they're trying to impact and the problem that they're trying to impact.
Who's creating the big problems? Is it the publishers, the distributors, such as the owners of the internet backbone, or both?
Well, the question is, are they the same people or different people at this point in time, too? Because, yes, in theory, you have the content providers and you have the providers of the pipes. And in theory, both of them can act as gatekeepers, as censors, as controllers. On the content side, we're more used to that. Everyone knows about conservative publishers and the impact of advertising income on content, which in theory doesn't exist. And in actuality, we find that it exists. When you're talking about pipes, you start to talk about throttling, you start to talk about blocking, you start to talk about technical differences in the way that information is processed that don't have tangible reasons. And that's why we had such a titanic net neutrality battle, which for now has come out in the right way. Whether that's going to stick as we go through this great legal battle, we don't really know. I'm optimistic that it may. But again, that's only a U.S. decision. So when we start talking about global pipes and when we start talking about a global information supply, the problem kind of outstrips what you're able to do within countries and within regulatory environments. Then you have a situation where the pipes and the content are getting married. So you have the ability to gatekeep on multiple fronts. We call that vertical integration. And what it means is content and pipes coming together in the same company. And one of our big examples of that is Comcast, which is also NBC. So they can gatekeep on both sides, and they can essentially work to advance their interests by using their pipes to promote their content and vice versa. That's a huge threat. Vertical integration of media is one of the biggest threats that's out there. Those of us that are on the radical side of media activism have said for years what we need here is structural separation. If you own pipes, you can't own content. And that is an idea that is apparently too radical for the world right now, but in the long term, that's where we should be headed.
In other words, a Glass-Steagall Act for the media.
Exactly.
The Glass-Steagall Act was an act passed during the Great Depression that prohibited commercial banks from owning investment banks.
Because really it incentivizes an entity exactly the wrong way, because all of their interests collide.
Should the technical side of the internet be nationalized?
That's a good question. I've been a long-term advocate of municipal and community broadband, which is essentially doing that, but doing it in little patchwork chunks, city by city or state by state or nonprofit by nonprofit. And the reason for it is that essentially it's the only competitive option that we have left, because the barriers to entry when you're talking about internet pipes are huge. You can't just really start up an ISP anymore. Those days are gone. It's a huge investment of infrastructure. So basically, you just have a couple companies left, and they are buying each other up rapidly. And so we're heading towards the last two survivors, if we're lucky. It may just be one megapolis in the end. So under that scenario, the question is, how do you create any competition at all? And so public internet infrastructure is one way that you can do that. And it's one of the few ways left. And we see that the big telecoms are fighting it tooth and nail because they can see that. Their route to a non-competitive universe is to wipe that stuff out. In terms of nationalizing, I mean, certainly to some degree, by establishing information services as a public utility, we have walked a couple of steps in that direction. But a regulated private utility is not the same as a nationalized service. My personal feeling is that the government would be, number one, over tasks if it were to take over the operation of the information services of the country. And secondly, that we have enough reasons to be concerned about the way that our government is using information right now to have some severe quandaries. And of course, this is one of those devil's advocate choices. Would you rather AT&T had all your data, or would you rather that the NSA had all your data, pick and choose? And the truth is that they both do, and both situations are kind of crummy. If you're asking me to pick which one is better, I don't know what the answer is.
Well, AT&T can give its information to the NSA.
That's exactly what's going on. So I don't think at this point nationalization of the media per se is the answer. If you take a look at someone like Robert McChesney, he would say that you want some kind of national subsidy for sort of public interest media. And maybe that kind of halfway step, like net neutrality, which is also a halfway step, are kind of the best things that we can do right now to keep a little bit of the public interest present.
But then wouldn't the big players like PBS get all the money?
Yeah, that's what you get into, and that's exactly how that would play out. I think that when McChesney was talking about it, and in fairness to him, he was talking about it 5 or 7 years ago, and I think probably his ideas have morphed somewhat. I mean, he was essentially talking about taxing for public media. And that's not going to be real popular. We know that. And it also creates a situation where what we're defining as public media will become very subject to gatekeeping. I think we can certainly think of a couple of stations that are likely to sort of collapse out of the public media definition when it becomes a government-funded service. But what he was concerned about was journalism and who's paying for it, and do we actually have a fourth estate that's meaningful if the fourth estate is broke?
I know that from personal experience. I recently read Ellen Hodgson Brown's article on how America has become an oligarchy. In it, she cited a Princeton study on political decision-making, and I wanted to read the study. But the links to it were stripped from Talking Points Memo and Scrib-D because of copyright complaints. The study is available from an academic journal, but it charges $30 to access it. That's 15% of what I'm getting paid before taxes for the article I'm writing, for which I'd want to read the study. Academic publishers have hegemony too, don't they?
Yeah, well, that's something that Aaron Swartz was pushing strongly as an internet activist, which is essentially the walling off of information. When you're talking about academics, it's lead information that's being walled off. And the public needs to be able to see this stuff. It's not a secret. It's the accumulated knowledge of the universe. And as you can see, that didn't go so well for him.
Aaron Swartz was a 26-year-old computer programmer, writer, and open democracy advocate, facing up to 35 years in prison and $1 million in fines for allegedly downloading a large trove of academic journal articles. 5 days after his arrest, Swartz was found hanged in his apartment. His death was ruled a suicide, but no suicide note was found. His many activities included work on the development of Creative Commons. How can something like Creative Commons help?
Well, I mean, certainly Creative Commons was a wonderful effort. Lawrence Lessig deserves a humongous amount of credit. And it has certainly permitted people to try to contribute their content to open source information economy that doesn't punish people for participating in it. But as everyone has said, Creative Commons is a volunteer compliance effort. It works if everybody plays by the rules. When there are bad actors, it doesn't. So it's a system that is a wonderful model and pilot of what could be. It's a utopian idea. But I'm not sure that it has quite enough to it to reverse all of the negative aspects of copyright and to essentially adjust for bad actors.
How do citizens get their media back?
Right.
And do they want it back?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of conversation within the journalism community that has to do with, well, we want to do investigative whistleblowing journalism. We want to hold government accountable and live up to the constitutional idea that we are the fourth estate, but nobody wants to pay us to do it. Nobody. And there was a certain amount of cynicism about the fact that it was essentially people selling sofas on the fourth page of the newspaper that provided the economic equity for the fourth estate, which is weird. And we never really came up with any kind of alternative model.
We've got to end money, which creates scarcity.
Monopoly, oligopoly is always an attempt to corner all the money and create scarcity unless you've got the monopoly, oligopoly power. I mean, that's why it's attractive, because you can make it scarce for everybody else. And that has huge advantages for those who own it. Not just the money, but the idea that everyone else can't get a piece of the action. So what can we do to get it back? I think for the interests of public interest media, I think it's been terrifying that people really haven't jumped in with eagerness to pay for it.
A blog article published by the Watershed Media Project called Journalism's Position in the Charitable Giving Ecosystem stated that, quote, "It turns out, in fact, that for all the declamations and examinations of journalism's importance to our democracy, actually funding its non-commercial public interest practice is one of the lowest priorities of the charitable sector, inclusive of major and individual philanthropy."
And then, you know, you can do an analysis about why part of it people were used to getting it free or very low cost. I think certainly the quality of much of the mainstream media has played a role. I think people have been gravely disappointed with a lot of what they've gotten. And I think it's fair to say most people's encounter with the media is fairly mainstream. They get the evening news, they watch 60 Minutes, they pick up the newspaper, and some of this has been pretty crappy over the past couple years, and there is a question of paying for a product to appreciate what the product gives you, or is it one crime description after another? You know, who needs it? And then you're sending me a bill and I don't want to pay it. So that's a part of it. For the alternative media, it's a different question, but I think people also have often been frustrated by what they've gotten. I think that the reasons are a little more complex in terms of what people want from alternative media. I think in some cases they want their own perceptions ratified because they feel very alienated by the mainstream. And I'm not sure that alternative media can do that to the extent that people want it to. I think sometimes people want their identity affirmed, which is a very important thing, but it's a very specific thing. And it's a hard thing to do for a multitude of the population and still maintain the affection of other multitudes of the population. I think it creates a difficult situation for alternative media, because really identity affirmation is something that should happen within the social fabric. And the fact that it doesn't, I think, leaves huge unmet needs. So that's a part of the problem, is people haven't really wanted to support a huge vital information sector out of their pocket. It's also expensive. And we don't have much money. I mean, that's another thing. When you defund the public, when wages are dropping and expenses are going up, and then you say, and by the way, the information society is now paid for by you, allocate an extra $75 a month, people laugh. They don't have the extra $75 a month or $50 a month or whatever it is that we would actually need to have a real information sector paid for by the people. And it probably does cost about that much. And we don't have it. So what are we going to do to get it back? I think we have to start talking about how the public money is spent, obviously. I think we do have to look at what alternative sustainable structures look like. And people are doing that. Low power radio is a small scale movement, but it's a movement towards what does sustainable media look like that the people can actually participate in and afford. I think we have to understand that media cannot continue to consolidate, and we have to fight these mergers as if they are really assaults on the public fabric, which is what they are, every last one of them. I mean, at this point, my opinion is nobody can merge with anybody, period. The specifics of each merger, the specific harms, the specific impacts are different, but in general, we have already passed the point of unacceptable media consolidation a decade ago. There is no upside at this point to increased consolidation. There is no merger that is good enough. There is no merger that is satisfactory. And that's not something that's a commonly accepted point of view. But for me, there is no benefit to increased media consolidation that I can find at all. So certainly on the net neutrality argument, which was essentially around gatekeeper power and fast and slow lanes on the internet, we were able, at least on a national level, for enough people to get upset about what that would mean to them, to really create, you know, an almost unmatched expression of public outrage. Now, I don't think that the issue was won just because of public outrage. I'm not that naive. The public gets outraged all of the time, and it doesn't always help us. But I do think that it presents a scenario where at least the David part of David and Goliath puts up a pretty good fight, and they have to balance the pros and the cons of moving forward with a kind of an increased, really, communication, fascist information control. So I think it's a process of both the little local sustainable efforts to, as we say, kind of, you know, poke holes or make little bits of space on the local level, and keeping up enough national pressure so that not all of these decisions go badly, and so that the pace of consolidation and surveillance and gatekeeping is not as quick as it might otherwise be.
So the public has to become global too.
Yes, and we're not very good at being a global public. How the people of the world speak as one, we don't know the answer to that. And part of that is the curse of nationalism, which has us identifying as Americans, not as global citizens. And that is also true of Nigerians. They also identify as Nigerians, not as people of the world. But we don't identify the shared interests, and our global corporate overlords have done a much better job of identifying their shared interests, while we sort of don't really have a counterforce to that. The environmental movement around climate change is probably the closest that I've seen of citizens' movements around the world to start breaking down some of those boundaries. But again, it's in the very early phases, and there's a long way to go. And certainly when it comes to media and information, we're like an infant compared to them, and they're maybe a college student. But the people that we're trying to impact here are senior citizens. They've been doing it for a long time, and it's well-developed, so we're not even close. But maybe in time we can start to identify what some of that global citizen advocacy starts to look like.
Is the conversation happening?
Well, it's a problem when you essentially peg a fourth estate as the check and balance to prevent governments from getting out of control. I mean, essentially that's how it was put together. We'll have a fourth estate, and therefore tyranny will not overtake the people, because this journalism thing, whatever you want to call it, will be a check and balance on the abuse of power. Well, that's a pretty central cog in the whole system, and it isn't working. It's a weak sector, and it doesn't protect anybody from tyranny at all. And I think that is essentially sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that if the sector's weak, it can't protect people. If it doesn't protect people, they're not going to pay for it. We talk about these big, huge problems and the need for global citizen advocacy, and the reality is, when the heck do people have time and resources to mount this kind of massive effort? It's impossible. Mm-hmm. Just like asking people, hey, can I have an extra $50 here so we can have a viable alternative media every month? They kind of laugh at you. Well, I'd like to eat. Do you mind?
You have been listening to Tracy Rosenberg, Executive Director of Media Alliance in the San Francisco Bay Area. Media Alliance is a media resource and advocacy center for media workers, nonprofit organizations, and social justice activists. Media Alliance's mission is excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. The website of Media Alliance is media-alliance.org. That's media-alliance.org. On April 23, 2015, the New York Times published an article announcing that Comcast was planning to end its $45 billion bid for Time Warner in the face of, quote, intense regulatory scrutiny, unquote. According to the article, quote, had the deal been approved, the combined company would have controlled as much as 57% of the nation's broadband market and just under 30% of pay television, unquote. Opponents feared, quote, that customers would end up paying more for declining service, that the industry behemoth would use its heft to stifle competition in the budding online video business, and that there would be a lack of independent and diverse voices on television. Comcast and Time Warner Cable consistently rank at the bottom of customer satisfaction surveys, unquote. I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Oakland, California.
That was Kelia Ramirez Watson's interview with Tracy Rosenberg of Media Alliance, a progressive media advocacy and education group based in the San Francisco Bay Area. You can listen to this and other of Kelia's podcasts by visiting www.patreon.com/Kelia and clicking the link to Creator Posts. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.